Legion is in touch with top advertising agencies and fashion designers. They'll line up casting calls for you. You'll get hired for jobs and make a bundle. Which was a line of bull if Janie had ever heard one. The thought of Herb Newman having any contact with a modeling agency was as far-fetched as her agreeing to a singing and dancing routine in the school talent show. Then, the full import of his words hit her. If no money changed hands for the pictures, where had Kelsey gotten $1,000? According to this man, she would have had to accept a modeling job in order to get paid. Doubt crept in. When would Kelsey have had time for that? And how would she have gotten to the job location without their mom taking her?
That's good. I like money.
You'll be raking it in when those advertisers get a look at these shots. I've seen girls that resemble you in Teen Vogue, not as good looking even.
Who would have guessed that Herb Newman, with the smelly food catcher beard, was capable of such lines? He and Olivia continued to chat as he took several more shot sequences.
About you, sweetheart.
It took a moment for Janie to realize he was directing the words at her.
You interested in pictures, too?
She probably will be when she sees mine.
Olivia bent forward at the waist, her low-cut shirt showing off her cleavage. Blew him a kiss. He captured the shot.
You took pictures of her sister a long time ago. That's how we knew about you.
Oh, yeah?
He threw an appraising look at Janie.
Who's your sister?
Kelsey Willard. Olivia glanced at her, clearly surprised that she hadn't had to speak for Janie. But the words had burst from her throat as if propelled. Kelsey, the reason they were here. The reason Janie needed answers from this man.
Yeah, I remember.
He studied her closely.
You don't look much like her.
No.
But you got your own look, right? And for $75, price I quoted to your friend here, you can get shots done, too. I'll make you look real good.
He turned his attention back to Olivia, and they proceeded to take full-body shots. Her friend seemed comfortable in her role. She'd had to pretend to be someone else most of her life, just to adapt to all the crappy situations she found herself in because of her deadbeat mother. Janie actually thought she was enjoying this a little bit. But Janie wasn't, especially since the man had admitted that he'd taken the pictures Kelsey had hidden in Janie's room shortly before she disappeared. Now that she'd gotten what she came for, she still had to figure out a way to get the information to the cops. Pulling out her cell, she checked the time and saw they'd been there 40 minutes already. She had to get Olivia home soon.
Okay.
Newman lowered his camera.
But you mentioned a tattoo. And if we're going for the punk look, we need some shots of it.
It'll be tasteful,
he added. Janie's brows rose. This from a man whose sweatshirt didn't quite manage to cover his ample belly. Every time he brought up the camera, a ribbon of doughy flesh was revealed.
Oh, I don't know, Olivia played coy. One's on my shoulder, but the other is on my butt.
That's fine, that's perfect. Remember what I said about eye-catching pictures? I'll turn around while you take your clothes off, and you can reveal as much as you're comfortable with.
His smile revealed stained teeth.
I've been doing this for a while. I've seen it all, and I'm a master at making you look like $1,000,000.
The phone in her pocket vibrated. It took a moment for Janie to remember what that meant. When she did, a streak of urgency zipped up her spine. We have to go. Olivia was quicker on the uptake than Janie had been. She was already grabbing her coat.
What? Hang on, I really need those pictures if you want to make it on the punk modeling scene. I gotta have more than the hair and the piercings to sell you to the agency I was telling you about. Come on, I can give you something to loosen up, then you can shed the clothes and let me get the shots.
I have to be home for dinner.
Swiftly, Olivia grabbed her purse, took out the envelope of money Janie had given her yesterday, and thrust it at the man.
Maybe we can finish up next week. There'd be no extra charge, right?
Another trip out here, another setup?
Newman was clearly disgruntled.
I can't do that for free.
The girls headed through the doorway. Without the flashlight Newman had given her, Janie couldn't see a thing in the darkness. "Should we look for a back door?" she whispered to her friend. Her cell was vibrating again. Two calls, what did that mean? Two different police cars? She ran into Olivia as the girl turned toward her. "I think we should just hide until they leave," Olivia began. But just as the words left her mouth, the front door swung open. A flashlight caught them in its beam.
"Alamo County Sheriff, don't move,"
a voice commanded.
Claire Willard, November 13th, 7:22 p.m. Your daughter's been arrested. The words echoed in Claire's head, but she couldn't put aside her sense of disbelief. The phone call had been a mistake. The deputy had someone else confused with Janie. Claire backed the car partway out of the garage before slamming on the brake. Janie's medication. Surely she was going to need it. She'd be swamped with anxiety in a situation like this. Did the girl have meds with her? She knew her daughter hadn't been taking them regularly. Claire had discussed the issue more than once with Dr. Drake. Mind racing, she recalled seeing a prescription bottle in the bottom of Janie's purse a few weeks ago, when Claire had been looking for her daughter's car keys. But did she have her purse with her? Driving back into the attached garage, she got out and unlocked the door to the house, racing upstairs to her daughter's bedroom. Flipping on the light, she took a quick look around, didn't see a purse. But as long as she was there, she continued into the attached bath and opened the medicine cabinet. Maybe the deputy had taken Janie's personal effects. That's what happened when a person was in custody, wasn't it? As long as Claire was here, she'd look for some unused... The thought fragmented as she stared, shocked. Every month, Claire dutifully refilled Janie's prescription and set it on her daughter's desk. And here most of them were, neatly lined up in a row, still full, or nearly so. 6 months' worth. Her hand rose of its own volition to turn each bottle so she could read the dates on them. June's was half full. The October bottle looked to be missing only a few pills. The one she'd just refilled for November was missing. Dazed, she reached for one of the bottles and hurried back to the garage. Her daughter's therapist liked to say that taking meds was Janie's choice. But how could the girl be expected to go to a strange town next year and acclimate to college life if she was refusing the most effective coping tool at her disposal? Worry about Janie consumed her as she drove to the courthouse, where the sheriff's office was housed. Throwing the car into park, she fumbled to turn it off and almost ran to the back entrance she'd been directed to by the deputy who'd called. "I'm Claire Willard, Janie Willard's mother." Claire spoke into the intercom outside the doors of the Alamo County Courthouse. The thought of her daughter, her baby, being inside these locked doors had the fear and confusion winding more tightly inside her. "I received a phone call. My daughter was brought here." "Just a moment." But it was long minutes before someone came to the door. Minutes in which she was very much aware that she was alone on a task that should have required the presence of both parents. Memory of the conversation she'd had with her husband immediately following the phone call still elicited anger. Janie? What could Janie have possibly done to get picked up by the sheriff's department? "I don't know, David. That's what we have to find out. You need to come home. I'm leaving for the courthouse now, but both of us should be there. Can you imagine what this is doing to her anxiety?" "Claire, you know I'm in Columbus. Even if I could leave, it'd be an hour and a half before I got there. You'll have Janie home by then. This is probably all a misunderstanding. You go. Call me when you learn something. And for God's sake, if they want to question her, make sure she has a lawyer present." There had been more, but the crux was the same. David's dinner with his boss and some clients took precedence over their daughter. Finally, an unsmiling, uniformed man came to the door, unlocked it, and let Claire inside. As she followed him down a hallway, a nasty, niggling thought blazed across her mind and wouldn't be banished. Whenever one of his children needed David, he never seemed to be available. "I want to be taken to my daughter. Immediately." There was a quaver in Claire's voice. I told the officer who called. She has an anxiety issue that requires medication. This situation has probably brought on a full-blown anxiety attack.
I'm going to have you talk to Sergeant Rossi, ma'am.
He led her to the elevators, and they traveled in silence to the third floor. Her heels echoed in the silent halls as she trailed behind him, trying to calm her nerves. At least she knew Janie was all right. But the girl had lied to Claire about working tonight. Janie never lied. She was truthful, to a fault at times. Dishonesty was totally out of character for her. But then, so was trespassing. Claire gave a slight shake of her head as the officer held open the door leading to the sheriff's office for her. Janie rarely went anywhere besides school and work. Where would she have trespassed? Nearly two-thirds of the desks behind the counter were empty, but a couple of smaller offices had lights blazing. It was to one of those spaces that the uniform showed her. Rossi's name was on the half-opened door.
Janie Willard's mother's here.
Mrs. Willard. The man inside rounded his desk and came to greet her.
Thank you for coming, ma'am. Please sit down.
Claire remained standing, twisting the handle of her purse between her fingers. I need to see Janie. Please take me to her. He gave a smile that was probably meant to be reassuring. It wasn't. He looked vaguely familiar, tall, brown hair with a matching droopy mustache. Had he been at the house when Kelsey's investigation was going on? Claire couldn't recall. There had been so many uniforms at first, before the BCI agents had taken over the case. So many questions asked, so few answers received.
She's fine. Shaken up, seems like. Hasn't spoken a word since Deputy Brennan found them in the vacant lake house out on Fuller Road.
He took her arm and steered her to a chair. She sank into it, uncomprehending. I don't understand. Why would she be there? And who is them?
Your daughter hasn't said anything. Not that we've attempted to question either her or her friend before parents arrived, he added hastily. But the other girl has spoken freely since being brought in, and her foster parents are with her now.
Foster parents. Olivia. Claire rubbed at a spot between her brows. Of course it would be. Was that girl the reason Janie had been somewhere she'd had no right to be?
It would be helpful, ma'am, now that you're here, if we can get Janie's story about why they were on someone else's property.
She isn't going to be able to talk to you. My daughter has an anxiety disorder. I have to go to her now. She needs her medication. Do you have her purse? She'd have pills in it. Otherwise, I've brought some from home.
I don't think your daughter had any belongings with her. Her car was parked next to the garage at the lake house. Maybe her things are inside it.
Then I need to see her now. Immediately.
That will have to wait until...
No, it will not wait. You will wait. Temper blazing, she bounced out of the chair to gaze up at the man who stood when she did. He was a good 5 inches taller, but he didn't intimidate her. Not with her imagination supplying her a vivid picture of the shape Janie was in right now. She'd be more than shaken up. No doubt she was in the grips of a full-blown anxiety attack, with all the accompanying emotional and physical reactions that came with it. Claire had witnessed plenty of those incidents after Kelsey had disappeared when Janie had regressed.
Unless you want me to press charges for denial of critical care while she's in your custody, you will allow me to give her the medication she's been prescribed for anxiety. Now.
Annoyance was visible in his expression as their gazes did battle. He was the first to look away.
It has to be a labeled prescription bottle with her name on it.
It is.
She dug in her purse, pulled out the bottle, and showed it to him.
All right. Deputy Krantz is the juvenile officer on duty. He's been splitting his time between the two of them. The story the other girl is telling is sort of far-fetched. A statement from Janie could clear up a lot of things. You should be aware, however, that given their ages, they could be charged as adults.
The man started out the door. Charged. A fist squeezed Claire's heart as she hurried after him down another hallway. David was right. She needed to call an attorney.
She tried to recall the name her husband had mentioned. Brant Strickland. He'd helped them through Kelsey's investigation. The memory had her stomach hollowing out. This was nothing like 7 years ago, she assured herself. Janie was fine, not lost to them, like her sister. A stocky man with a blonde crew cut stepped into the hallway, pulling a door closed behind him. Rossi spoke to him.
This is Mrs. Willard. Ma'am, Deputy Krantz.
I need to see my daughter.
She's right inside here, ma'am. She seemed to be in some distress a while ago, so I brought her a glass of water.
The words torched Claire's fear and galvanized her into action. She pushed by Rossi and rushed to the door, opened it. There was a small scarred table in the center of the room. Her daughter sat on one side of it, facing her, arms wrapped tightly around her waist. When she saw Claire, her lips quivered once before she firmed them.
Janie.
Claire rushed to her side, sank to her knees beside her daughter's chair.
Deep breath. Blow it out, again. Use your self-talk. I am not controlled by my anxiety. It's okay to be overwhelmed. I am strong enough to get through this.
She'd recited the affirmations with Janie often enough years ago that they were embedded in her brain. She took her daughter's hand in both of hers, felt the clammy moisture of her palm, and was transported to the time after Kelsey was taken. When Janie's progress had taken a giant leap backward, when the anxiety had produced night terrors, a galloping heart, sweaty palms, and strangled breathing, habit had her checking the pulse in her daughter's wrist, was surprised to find it rapid, but not racing.
It's okay, Mom. I'm okay.
I've brought your meds. Claire set her purse down on the floor and twisted off the top to the small bottle she still held. I know you haven't been taking them. You need one now.
No, the worst is over.
Janie was turned in her chair to face her, her gaze focused on Claire's face. Recognizing the coping strategy for what it was, Claire nearly wept. Janie could speak if she successfully blocked out the others in the room, focused on her mother. Pretended there were no strangers present. It meant she was still struggling to keep the debilitating waves of nerves in check.
Baby.
Claire's voice trembled as she reached up with her free hand to brush back her daughter's long, dark hair.
Why won't you just make it easier on yourself?
In answer, Janie captured her hand in one of hers. With the other, she reached into her pocket and took something out, set it on the table before her, clicked a switch.
You need to be strong.
Janie's whisper was nearly lost as voices filled the room.
Yeah, yeah, the punk look is totally popular right now.
Claire frowned in confusion.
Who's the man talking to?
Shh.
The admonishment came from Sergeant Rossi. Glancing his way, she saw his brows furrow. He and Deputy Krantz appeared to be listening intently.
So, how does this deal work? I mean, how do I make money off this gig? Can I get paid for these pictures?
Janie's hand tightened on hers. A terrible wave of deja vu swept over Claire.
Oh, Janie, no.
Her voice trembled, and for a moment, she thought she'd be sick, right there where she knelt next to her daughter's chair. It was like being frozen in place on the tracks as a runaway locomotive hurtled toward her. She could do nothing to prevent it. There was no way to stop the inescapable collision of the past and present.
How about you, sweetheart? You interested in pictures, too?
She probably will be when she sees mine. You took photos of her sister a long time ago. That's how we knew about you.
Claire pressed the hand that still held the prescription bottle to her lips, but couldn't prevent a tiny moan from escaping.
Oh, Janie.
An inner wail echoed in her brain.
What have you done?
Oh, yeah? Who's your sister?
Kelsey Willard.
Yeah, I remember. You don't look much like her.
Janie switched off the recorder. The contrasting silence in the room was deafening. Gaze still locked with Claire's, she said,
You told the investigators back when Kelsey went missing. You'd heard something about a man photographing young girls, but it never led anywhere.
At least not that you ever heard. Claire stared at her, recognizing the lies she'd told her daughter only days earlier. Now they were a lifeline, an offer of rescue from her own sea of dishonesty.
I don't know if they ever followed up, but we never heard anything more about it.
The words were for the deputy's benefit. How humbling that her 17-year-old daughter had found a way to free Claire's secret after all these years. How humiliating that she'd had to do so at all, and in a way that left her mother blameless. Claire had an overwhelming urge to reach into the bottle she still held and swallow a couple of the pills inside. The one she'd taken after the call from this office had done little to quiet the apprehension that was spiking and careening inside her right now.
Is there more on that recording?
Janie switched it on again, but the words tumbled over Claire with no meaning. The old fear she'd lived with since she'd made that fateful decision to destroy the photos was a fanged beast, and it was devouring her now. What could the police have learned from the pictures themselves that they couldn't have discovered from the lie she'd given them? Nothing. She still believed that. But she was well-versed in the art of self-delusion. She knew she couldn't rely on her own rationalizations for the truth.
Who is he? Her words sounded rusty. Who's the man on the tape?
His name is Herb Newman, ma'am. He's a janitor at West Bend High School.
A distant ping of recognition sounded, but Claire's thoughts were too scattered to pursue it. Olivia heard a rumor from someone at a party she attended a few weeks ago about Newman taking pictures of Kelsey. The tightness with which Janie was squeezing Claire's hand had her wincing a little.
We wanted to find out for ourselves, hear him admit it. I figured if I had proof, the police would have more to go on this time. They could question him about his contact with Kelsey. Maybe he'd never been questioned before.
This close to her daughter, looking into her eyes, Claire knew the girl was lying. Her expression was too determined, a glint of warning, a light in her gaze. Despite the disability that still took its toll, Janie had an indomitable will. Hadn't Dr. Drake said as much many times over the years? Slowly, Claire rose, using the edge of the table to support herself. She looked at Rossi.
What will you do with that man?
You can't let him go free. Not without discovering. We're still holding him, ma'am.
If Claire hadn't found the sergeant intimidating before, his expression now was positively forbidding.
You can be sure we'll take all steps to learn what he knows. We'll also turn the information over to the BCI.
I'm taking my daughter home.
Her only remaining daughter. The one who'd taken a bold, reckless risk to aid the investigation into her sister's disappearance. Claire teetered between pride and fear. The two deputies exchanged a glance.
Under the circumstances, the recording has corroborated the other girl's story. I need Janie to write up a statement about the events of tonight before she goes.
And the charges?
Claire didn't know where she found the strength to look the man in the eye.
They did your office a huge favor by bringing this information to you.
Information that could have been shared with a phone call, instead of engaging in an entrapment scene out of a Hollywood plot.
She heard her daughter snort, and the sergeant's mouth twitched beneath the mustache.
But, admittedly, the recording carries a lot of weight. It's possible that the girls won't be charged in return for your daughter's promise not to engage in unlawful activity again.
Deputy Krantz approached Janie with a legal pad and pen.
Be sure to include how you gained access to the lake house this evening, he instructed.
After a moment, Janie picked up the pen and began writing.
I have other concerns to attend to. I want to assure you, Mrs. Willard, that this matter will be investigated thoroughly.
Rossi's words held a note of sincerity. But it was Janie that Claire was focused on, bent over the notepad and scribbling away with a freedom denied her with the spoken word.
I believe you will.
But that's all thanks to my daughter,
isn't it?
David Willard, November 13th, 10:36 p.m. As silently as possible, David crept out of bed and tiptoed toward the front door at the townhouse, where he called Claire again. Waited impatiently while the cell rang four times and went to voicemail. Frustration mounting, he called his daughter's phone. Same result. He stared into the shadows, 100 different scenarios circling in his mind. Claire should have called by now. It had been nearly 3.5 hours. He shouldn't have let her handle Janie's situation alone. His wife could handle little on her own these days. And Janie, what the hell had gotten into his daughter? Trespassing? Or had Claire gotten that wrong? The girl barely went anywhere outside of school, the Dairy Whip, and the library. Nothing about the few details Claire had provided made sense. The questions had echoed in his mind for hours, making sitting through the dinner with the execs from Ralston Electronics interminable. Somehow he'd managed to say the right things, laugh on cue at Kurt's jokes, all of which he'd heard 100 times before. The whole time he'd been expecting to have to excuse himself for a phone call that had never come. Twice he'd surreptitiously texted Claire with a similar lack of response. Maybe he should call the sheriff's office. David considered the idea, found it unappealing. He'd had his fill of law enforcement types recently, after fielding another call from that fucking Foster. The memory had his gut churning. He'd have an ulcer from that prick before all this was done. Just as David had feared, the agent must have gotten all of David's reservations from the hotel, not just the ones under the company's name. And he'd had some not-so-innocent questions about them, too. David hadn't given him the same answers he'd offered Grayson. He couldn't risk having the man corroborate his story with Claire. Instead, he'd spun a story about meeting potential clients on his own, which was frowned upon by the company. That job fell to Kurt and Martin, and while David had done exactly that in order to get the Bonner nursery account, he'd woven an elaborate cover story, making his initial meeting with Bonner seem accidental. David was very adept at cover stories. He tried Claire again, then his daughter. No response. At a loss, he strolled through his contacts until he found the attorney name he'd given Claire. The call was answered on the second ring.
Brant Strickland?
Brant. David kept his voice hushed. It's David Willard.
Yes, how are you?
The man's circumspect manner gave nothing away. David heard him murmur,
Deal me out this hand.
I'm sorry to take you away from the poker game. The man played every Friday night. I'm in Columbus, and there's been some trouble with my daughter tonight. I told Claire to call you, but I haven't been able to reach her. Have you heard from her?
From your wife?
The surprise in the attorney's voice sent David's spirits even lower.
No, I can't recall the last time I've spoken to her. What kind of trouble?
Some sort of trespassing thing. I'm afraid I don't have many details. And now that it was clear that Strickland didn't either, David was eager to end the conversation.
I'm really sorry to have bothered you. Looks like I'm going to have to drive home and handle this myself. Well, give me a call when you get more information if I can help out. Unless there was vandalism involved, a simple trespassing charge won't be difficult to get dismissed.
I will, thanks. I'll let you get back to your game.
No problem.
So Claire hadn't called Strickland. Because she hadn't needed him? If that was the reason, why wouldn't she have reported that to him? The cell in his hand vibrated. An incoming text. Finally, David opened it to read it. From Janie. And maddeningly cryptic. Everything will be fine. Taking care of Mom. Will be? Damn it. What was that supposed to mean? Were they home then? They'd have to be in order for Janie to access her phone, wouldn't they? He called his daughter. Felt his blood pressure rise when, once again, it went to voicemail. Fuming, he considered his options. He was going to have to drive back to West Bend. There was another get-together set here for tomorrow night, drinks this time with the client Kurt was courting. It could be done without David, but he was loath to miss out. It was unusual for him to be included at this juncture in the process. The invitation made it likely that if the account was won, it would be added to David's roster. He wouldn't miss it, he decided in the next moment.
With any luck, he could drive back tomorrow evening after dealing with whatever was going on at home. Decision made, he rose.
What are you doing up? Who are you talking to?
He looked over his shoulder at the woman silhouetted in the hallway. Just the outline of her figure in the filmy nightgown was enough to have desire stirring.
I have to go.
The regret in his voice was genuine.
Something's come up that I have to deal with. Hopefully I'll be back tomorrow. David, no.
There was a pout in her voice.
You just got here. Surely you can wait until Monday.
If I had a choice, I wouldn't go. Believe me. He crossed to her and drew her into his arms, pressing a lingering kiss on her mouth. After a moment's hesitation, she returned it with enough heat to get his pulse racing.
I'll make it up to you,
he whispered against her lips. I promise.
Special Agent Mark Foster, November 13th, 10:48 p.m. Are my eyes bleeding? Check and tell me if my eyes are bleeding. Sloane pushed away from the table and yawned delicately, stretching her arms over her head to arch her back. After a rundown of their respective days, they'd worked largely in silence, transcribing their reports and reading over those submitted by the various law enforcement entities partnered on the case, before turning their attention to the seemingly endless information from the Willard and TMK investigations. Ignoring her remark, Mark sat back in his chair, staring broodingly at the computer screen. Did you know the agency has another profiler? I had heard they'd replaced Luther Sims in that position. The woman moved her shoulders tiredly.
Oh, Greg Larson? I knew he'd be taking some extra training. I have never worked with him in that capacity, though.
Why? Because my SAC mentioned that Larson is familiar with the Willard case. If he's acting as agency profiler, I'm guessing he's pored over the TMK files. He tapped the screen, indicating the email he'd been reading. Might not hurt to get his perspective on the offender. I talked to Sims and got his.
You did?
Sloane eyed him.
You didn't tell me that.
Mark shrugged, avoiding her gaze. It probably wasn't necessary. She'd reverted to a casual, business-like persona that he already knew could be turned on and off at will. For the first time, he wondered if he'd been the first colleague she'd come on to during a case, and if he'd been the first to turn down her offer. Sloane Medford was a tenacious investigator and an assertive agent. She was doing a fast rise at the BCI. A year ago, he wouldn't have doubted that her ascent was based solely on merit. Now, he was questioning that perception, but not as much as he was questioning himself. His conversation with Kelly last night had been stilted. They'd been fine as long as they'd stuck to Nikki, but when she'd asked about the older agent's replacement, Mark had frozen. Finally, muttered something about Kelly, not knowing him, and changed the subject. Him. A lie. Because Sloane Medford was definitely not male. He deliberately worked past the time for a call tonight. It was getting harder and harder to rationalize the omissions and half-truths. He hadn't cheated 5 months ago. Mark's face flushed as he shoved aside the memories that threatened. Yeah, he was ashamed at how close he'd come. In bed, both half-undressed, hands racing everywhere. But he'd come to his senses. He'd walked away. Eventually. The memory was uncomfortable. Shunting it aside, he refocused. I wouldn't mind comparing Larson's take to Sims's. In fact, it might be interesting to see where the two men's views on the case intersected and diverged. Before he could forget, he quickly composed an email to that end and sent it to Larson. Since it was the weekend, he probably wouldn't hear back from the man until Monday. She shrugged, disinterestedly.
I don't put a lot of stock in that kind of thing. Evidence is what solves a case.
Yeah, well, you may not have noticed, but there's been a shortage of that so far in this investigation. They had plenty of unanswered questions, lots of potential subjects of interest, but they'd struck out with the Starkey family, and they hadn't yet landed on the one solid lead that would put this case to rest. And until they did, Whitney DeVries remained in the hands of a monster.
Do you think she's still alive?
He was getting used to the way Sloane could fix onto his thoughts.
Yeah, he keeps them for a while, according to Sims.
That had also been documented in the Infinite TMK files. No evidence of sexual assault, but plenty of signs of physical abuse, some torture. Had that come from Sims or the files? Mark couldn't recall. All the details of the past serial cases were starting to run together. But we're at the 2-week point since the girl was taken. She's almost definitely still alive. What she'd endured to this point, Mark thought grimly, was another matter.
So?
The topic seemed to have refueled Sloane's energy. She inched her chair up to the table again.
There's been nothing new from cyber forensics?
No. And there wouldn't be, Mark knew. The offender was too wily for that. Patrick Allen's hacked Facebook persona had been used only long enough to get Whitney to give the man her phone number, when their communications had switched to text messages at his suggestion. You can bet he's destroyed the burner phone. This offender was too smart not to do that. If indeed they were dealing with the TMK, he'd evaded capture precisely because he didn't make rookie mistakes. One thing Sims mentioned during our conversation has stuck with me. He swiveled his chair to face her as he spoke. Something about a victim they were able to prove was the work of a copycat. With no body for Willard and DeVries taken so recently, there's no way to be certain if either of them were indeed TMK victims, or the work of someone wanting us to think so. Sloane tapped a finger on the table before her. Which is why I think it's a mistake to get too tied up in what the profilers say about the 10-mile killer. We have no way of knowing if that's who we're dealing with. That was only one of the sources of the frustration that was starting to eat at him a little more each day. And no way to know if we're not. He used his phone to check the time and stood up abruptly. I've got to go. I'm meeting Brian DeVries. I'm going to hit him with everything we've discovered on this Starkey thing.
He's had plenty of time to get his story straight, she observed, rising as he did and grabbing her coat. Want me to go at him? Maybe he'll respond better to a softer approach.
She buttoned her coat. Mark shrugged into his coat. We'll play it by ear. On the way out the door, his cell rang.
Agent Foster, this is Sergeant Rossi of the Alameda County Sheriff's Office. I've been meaning to give you a call to apprise you of a situation that occurred this evening. Just now got the chance.
They reached Mark's car, Sloane meeting him at the driver's side, her hand out, waggling her fingers for the keys. He moved the phone away from his mouth.
You drive when we take your car.
She rolled her eyes, but rounded the hood and got in on the other side. He settled himself behind the wheel, buckling himself in one-handedly while he hung onto the cell. What do you have, Sergeant? Mark started the car and nosed it out of the motel parking lot, heading south for the address DeVries had given them. With each passing mile, Mark focused less on his upcoming meeting and more on the information being relayed. When the officer had finished, he said, Thanks for the call, and I'd appreciate being kept apprised of your progress.
You got it.
Disconnecting, he slipped the phone back in his pocket and slowed to a stop at a red light as his mind flipped through a mental Rolodex of names, came up with the one he was searching for.
Well? Sloane drawled. That was the locals, I gather. My mind reading's a little rusty. You're gonna have to share what that was about.
You recognize the name Herb Newman? After a pause, she answered.
He was on the list Mickelson gave us, right? The janitor shared by some of the churches in the area?
He's also the daytime janitor at West Bend High School. He must juggle the church jobs on nights and weekends. He was picked up tonight for trespassing. The other agent turned more fully in her seat to face him.
And we need to know this because...
He was with Janie Willard and another girl. Janie is Kelsey Willard's sister. The guy claims to be some sort of photographer with contacts at a modeling agency. They provided a recording they'd made of the man admitting he'd taken pictures of Kelsey Willard before her death. The light turned green. Mark pulled out into the intersection. There was remarkably little traffic for a Friday evening.
A link to Willard through the school, Sloane mused. Possibly to Willard and DeVries through the church. We need to talk to him.
We will. I want to double check whether he was ever interviewed 7 years ago. If Mark had read a transcript of the interview, he had no recollection of it. They released the teenagers, but have Newman in custody. He had what they believe are Oxy and K2 on him, and he offered it to the girls. Apparently, the county's had a problem with an unknown local dealing drugs, and they started wondering if it were Newman.
Deputies went back to the house to look around a bit more, and their search turned up traces of cocaine in one of the bedrooms. They have enough to hold them while they tear the place apart looking for more drugs. The kids indicated he had a key to the place, and the empty property has been a magnet for teenagers and parties for years. Mark was less interested in the man's other pastimes than he was in the link between Newman and Willard. They brought in a drug dog for the search, but we can probably wait and talk to him tomorrow. He slowed, then turned into the parking lot of the pub's bar and grill. Think this is the same place DeVries met with Starkey a few years back?
Only one way to find out.
Sloane released her seatbelt and opened the door of the vehicle.
Let's go ask him.
You omitted Dane Starkey's name from your list of acquaintances.
He wasn't,
Brian DeVries started. You failed to tell us about a potential suspect in this case, a man with reason to seek revenge on you, Mark continued inexorably. You lied about why you were paying him off, and when we talked about the church Whitney occasionally attended, somehow you forgot to mention that you'd spent quite a bit of time around it when you took care of the mowing there one summer. When was that, Brian? Did you know Kelsey Willard? Is that where you first saw her?
Who?
The man shook his head as if to dislodge the words.
No, it wasn't like I was mowing when kids were outside. That was at least 10 years ago.
He probably just forgot about the lawn job.
Sloane's voice was soft, understanding.
The man has the weight of the world on his shoulders right now. His daughter's missing, for God's sake. Have a little compassion.
Yes, I just didn't think about it. It was a long time ago. And as far as Starkey...
Yeah, let's talk about him. If Sloane's tone was cotton batting, Mark's was granite. Or better yet, let's talk about Shelley Starkey, the 12-year-old girl you sexually assaulted in the basement bathroom of Lewis Starkey's house when you were 15.
That's bullshit!
A couple of men at a neighboring table looked over at Brian's vehement protest. Lowering his voice, he went on.
First of all, she came on to me. I thought she was a couple of years older, and she never said no until later.
Until you almost raped her? He looked away, a muscle jumping in his jaw.
It wasn't rape, and I stopped when she started struggling. I don't know if she's the one who spun it or if it was her parents to get money from my mother, because her dad was all about calling the cops when he came storming over. But he shut up pretty quick when my mother pulled out the checkbook.
You could have told Agent Foster that. Innocent until proven guilty, right? But hiding it, you have to know how it looks.
DeVries scrubbed his hands over his face as Sloane spoke. The man looked like he'd aged 10 years since his daughter went missing.
And risk having it show up in the official report? I wasn't ignoring the possibility that Starkey could be behind it.
He snapped his mouth shut on whatever he'd been about to say. Too late, because Mark could already predict the rest. You even spent your days back at work digging into the lives of the Starkey family, right? Did some investigating of your own, using law enforcement tools on searches you weren't authorized to perform. What do you think your sheriff would have to say about that?
I was desperate. Think I can't tell my office is coming up empty checking on punks I've arrested?
That had been a task Mark had left to the Fenton County Sheriff's Office, something he was regretting now. The sheriff had showed a lack of common sense, letting DeVries anywhere near the office while the investigation was ongoing. The man continued.
Like you say, Starkey was a logical suspect, and I took a hard look at him, even though I didn't really think the gutless prick had it in him, but his relatives?
He looked from Mark to Sloane, back again.
You've checked them out, right? Because they could have been in on it with Dane.
Disgusted with the man, with the situation, Mark pushed away from the table. We haven't come up with a thing on any of them, and believe me, we looked. Here's what you're going to do, Brian. You're calling the sheriff tomorrow. Say you made a mistake going back to work and need some time at home. I don't give a shit what you tell him, but if I find out you're anywhere near that office again without my okay, I'm laying it all out for him. Every lie you told me. You won't have a job to go back to. He might not anyway. Mark couldn't keep this information from the sheriff indefinitely. It was up to DeVries' employer to weigh the man's circumstances against his illicit use of law enforcement search tools and databases. DeVries gave him a terrible smile.
You gonna threaten me now? Someone took my little girl. Losing a job can't come close to a loss like that.
Of course it can't. Sloane was comforting. And you can't risk tainting this investigation by being anywhere near it. You're a cop. You know that.
Tell me you've got something.
DeVries's voice was pleading.
At least that you're close. You've got a person of interest. Something.
Go home, Brian. Mark was suddenly weary. It was possible, he was finding, to have sympathy for the man while wanting to slug him. Waiting for news on your daughter is the worst kind of torture, but that's what you have to do. We're looking into several areas. We're talking to people with links to both Kelsey Willard and your daughter. In fact, we just discovered another one who we'll be interviewing tomorrow. The best way you can help us do our jobs is to be open and honest with us. Hope had bloomed in the man's expression.
So you do have a suspect?
He's a person of interest until we determine otherwise, and we'll let you know either way. Go home to your wife and son now. They need you.
I want to know who you've talked to. Everyone you've eliminated.
Already the man was reverting to form and issuing demands.
We'll tell you what we can, Sloane promised.
The man's chair scraped as he pushed out of it. Without another word, he turned on his heel and walked away.
Well,
Sloane watched the man's exit.
What should we do as an encore? Find some puppies to stomp?
He put himself into this situation. He's hardly blameless. Mark was used to treating parents with kid gloves, but Brian DeVries could have derailed this investigation by inserting himself into it. Mark's cell vibrated. He turned off the ringer for this conversation, but it was the third time since they'd sat down that it had alerted. Pulling the phone from his pocket, he squinted at the number that showed on the screen. The same one who'd called him at the motel. He answered it. Mark Foster.
Agent?
Mark recognized Sergeant Rossi's voice, but it had lost its dispassionate tone. The edge of excitement in it was difficult to miss.
I'm at the lake house with my crime scene team. The drug dog alerted to a spot in the bedroom next door to where Newman had the girls. Someone had chiseled out a stone from the fireplace, and there was quite a haul in the empty space.
Congratulations.
That's why we decided to take the dog through the whole place. We're in the basement now. The dog didn't alert, not with the sit and bark it gives for narcotics, but it kept whining and returning to the west wall.
Mystified, Mark said, okay.
There's a crawl space there covered by a screen.
Mark glanced at Sloane, and his expression had her leaning forward in interest.
There's something inside. We're not sure what. Could be some sort of contraband that's been hidden away, but we called the coroner. Because whatever's in there looks like it's in a body bag.
The address Mark had been given wasn't difficult to find, despite its isolation. The light bars atop the official vehicles parked outside the house were as visible from the blacktop as a beacon. He pulled up the steep, winding drive and parked in back of a white van marked Alma County Coroner. Neither of them spoke as he and Sloane got out of the vehicle. They made it up the front steps before the door opened and a uniform stepped out. From his garb, Mark pegged him as a reserve deputy. BCI, Agents Foster and Medford. The man took their credentials and examined them under the beam of his mag light before nodding and handing them back.
They're in the basement. Follow me.
Large spotlights dotted the empty space they walked through. The rough log cabin walls, stone fireplace, and beamed ceilings provided rustic touches to what had once been a luxurious home. Mark recognized the quality of the polished wood floor, the intricate woodwork around the doors and windows. The kitchen they entered next was similarly well-equipped, but somewhat dated. He wondered how long the property had been empty. Then they started down the split log steps, and all other thoughts vanished.
Sending BCI down!
The reserve called from behind them. Mark led the way. The basement had been left unfinished, with the same stone he'd seen on the fireplace upstairs used for the walls. The floor was cement. The space was open and ran the length of the house. But it was full right now. More spotlights were set up. No cords, Mark noted, so there was no electricity in the place. There was a collapsible wheeled gurney in the center of the room, and a collection of men standing around a rectangular cavity high in the west wall. A screen had been removed and was leaning against the wall near the floor. He identified Rossi by the three stripes on his uniform coat. He was standing near a short, balding man in civilian clothes. Adrenaline thrummed inside him as Mark made his way toward them.
Sheriff Jeff Richards,
the shorter man introduced himself.
You're just in time. We haven't touched a thing. Waited for the coroner.
Mark and Sloan stood in silence as two individuals, standing on an overturned crate of some sort, worked a wide, canvas-covered board into the opening. With one man lifting the edge of the object inside, the other was able to work the board beneath it an inch at a time. Minutes later, Mark moved forward with Rossi and Richards to help balance the board and its contents as it was withdrawn and gingerly lowered to the gurney. The sergeant had been right. It looked like a black body bag, if an extra large one. It hadn't been especially heavy. Mark's pulse quickened as they got the bag settled on the gurney. One of the men wearing a flak jacket with coroner emblazoned across reached out a gloved hand to unzip the circular zipper on top. The sound echoed in the silence.
Jesus!
One of the deputies muttered, pressing his nose into the crook of his arm. Mark's stomach plummeted, not because of the smell that emanated from the bag, but what that smell meant. Rossi raised his flashlight, catching the bag's contents in its beam.
Ah, shit.
Mark's tone was bleak as his gaze traveled from the tip of one black ballet slipper up the tights-clad legs, the left drawn up to rest alongside the opposite knee. The tulle of the pink tutu had been smashed by the bag. The matching leotard was long-sleeved, and the skeletal arms were arranged above the head. He saw something on the bony fingers. Wire, holding the hands in a clasped position. The long, dark hair was intact. Not much of the facial skin was, but in his gut, he had no doubt. They'd found Kelsey Willard.
Whitney DeVries, November 14th, 10:37 p.m. She lay on the mattress, silently counting away the hours. Whitney had thought about her plan all day, mentally polished it during every second of the hated practice. It had run through her mind on a constant loop, even while she talked to the freak, who had noted her distraction. Missing her mom and dad had been Whitney's excuse, which was no more than the truth. It had pissed off the freak, she could tell, resulting in another one of his lectures about gratitude and her good fortune for having the opportunity for a new family. Every time he used the word, she hated him a little more. The computer had gone dark long ago, but she didn't dare move yet. Whitney had no way of knowing if the freak lived on the premises, but if he did, she wanted to be sure he was deeply asleep before she started working on loosening the bar. The clanking of the chain would be difficult to avoid. She couldn't risk waking him. She was already taking a big enough chance without adding to it. Maybe this place was soundproofed. That would make sense, wouldn't it? Screaming and crying for help had been the one rule she hadn't broken. She was afraid he might always be close by, even though he usually entered early in the morning and the evening. And when the computer was on, he'd know. According to her mental calculations, it was time, or close to it. Ice crept up her spine, and that had nothing to do with the chilly temperature in the dungeon. She didn't think she could handle it if her plan failed, shattering hopes of escape. Without hope, what would be the use of going on? Kelsey had, though. The memory gave her strength. The other girl had mentioned she'd been kept close to a year. And although Whitney hadn't finished reading all the pages under the floorboards, it helped her to know someone else had been through this. Maybe survived. With newfound resolve, she got up and retrieved the screw. Hauling in a deep breath, she made her way from memory to the back wall, to the bar. The metal was cold to the touch. Whitney slid her fingers along it until she came to the end nearest the window, where the bracket secured it to the wall. The narrow strip of light edging the curtain didn't make a dent in the shadows this far across the stage. She ran her fingers over the bracket, lingering on the screws that held it firm. She chose the first screw in the lower facing of the bracket, flathead, single groove in the center. Tipping the one she'd retrieved from the shower, she fit the top edge inside that groove, exerted pressure. The screw in her hand slipped, the point gouging her palm. Whitney brought the injured area to her mouth, sucked at the sting before trying again. In theory, the screw could be used like the flat tip of a screwdriver. Without the handle and shaft, it would be difficult to apply the needed force to turn the stationary screw. But hopefully not impossible. An hour into the task, Whitney was becoming frustrated. The threads of the screw she held dug into her fingers, making them swollen and sore. She solved the problem by wrapping the extra fabric of the flannel nightgown around the screw shaft for cushioning. When she tired, she alternated actions by bracing her feet against the wall and yanking outward on the bar, trying to loosen it. The movement sent the chain rattling, so she didn't dare repeat it for long, and then she switched tasks again, with very little result. She reached up an arm to wipe her forehead on the sleeve of her nightgown, discouraged. The screws in the bracket were tight. The freak probably checked on things like that before he brought a new victim here. The thought was accompanied by a wave of bitterness. There was no reason her idea wouldn't work. She just needed to keep trying. Or like Mrs. Zahner used to say in math class, work smarter, not harder. But what would be smarter? She considered for a moment. Then she refit the screw edge to the groove again, taking care to keep the contact as tight and close as possible. Pressing forward to exert as much force as she was capable of, she wrenched at the stationary screw again, and was rewarded when it moved, ever so slightly. Thrilled, Whitney promptly tried it a second time. In her haste, the screw she was wielding slipped and gouged her palm again. Grinding her teeth, she repeated the action more carefully. And there was another minute movement in the bracket screw. Panting with exertion, she grinned in delight. Without an actual screwdriver, her range of motion was limited to small half circles before she had to stop, refit the screw in the groove, and restart. But it was progress. She didn't waste time wondering what she'd do when she got all the screws free, or how long it might take. For now, she was going to enjoy the thrill of anticipation. The first step was freeing herself from the bar. Then she'd figure out how to escape.
Janie Willard. November 15th, 11 a.m. Cole Bogart parked next to her in the parking lot of a small coffee shop, Homebrew. Janie's pulse skittered as she watched him get out of his car and dash over to her passenger door, pull it open, and slide into the front seat. Damn, it's cold! He leaned forward to turn her heat up and scrubbed his bare hands in front of the vent where the air poured out. Will you believe my heater wouldn't work this morning, piece of shit? It's like stuck on defrost or something. I had to stop and scrape the inside of my windshield twice on the way over.
Gloves might have helped.
He grinned at her.
Your text didn't give me much time to get ready. What's up?
In answer, she dug into her purse beside her and handed him an envelope. It took two trips to the ATM to get enough cash. I want to pay you back for the listening devices. He made no move to take the money.
No, I told you we're cool. I'm going to return the whole box. The purchase will be credited back to my mom's account. All I need is for you to give me back the... Oh.
Yeah. She didn't know him well. Still had the tightness in her chest whenever she talked to him. But she could talk to him. Janie didn't know exactly what that meant. Maybe it was easier because they'd texted a few times over the weekend about what had gone down in the cabin. But more likely, it was because he'd barged into her house a few days back and made it impossible to avoid him.
So, you gave the recorder to the cops?
Slowly, he reached out a hand for the envelope. I don't know when we'll get it back. He thought for a minute.
I've got to get the charge taken care of. But if you do get the recorder back within 30 days, I can still return it, and you'd get this money back.
Yeah. I don't know if that will happen. Janie had no idea how long it would be before the sheriff's office would return it, if they did at all.
Me either. Sorry you got stuck paying for it.
Cole folded the envelope and shoved it into his coat pocket. It was worth it. Getting hauled into the sheriff's office hadn't exactly been in her plans, but the end result had turned out better than she'd anticipated. Newman had been caught up along with them, and she was guessing he'd had drugs on him. At least, she assumed that was what he'd meant by offering Olivia something to loosen her up. If so,